official good morning. So I want to talk about don't know mind. And there was, you know, it's one of the things that we say that you should have don't know mind. And in Buddha Dharma magazine, which we subscribe to, and I always forget to bring it downstairs, so my bad. At any rate, they have a regular column called Ask the Teachers, and then people write in and ask a question. And then the magazine has three different teachers from three different traditions respond to the question. So this one, the question was, Zen teachings speak of the importance of not knowing or don't know mind. Trying to stay with that mind has been a powerful practice for me more than once. It's kept me from jumping to an incorrect assumption or unskillful action. But at some point, don't we also need to do something? What's the threshold for saying, I know I don't know, but I know enough to draw a conclusion and act on it? What's the threshold for acting? Do we need to, at some point, do something? And I don't know, this is the summer 2020 issue, but I don't know exactly when these things got written. None of the responses make any reference to COVID-19 nor to Black Lives Matter and so on. But this one in particular from Angel Kyodo Williams seems to me apt for any time. I mean, some of them, she didn't talk about any particular decision. Some of the others seem to think of it as something to do with, you know, and it can, I mean, anything, but like a decision about a job or a relationship or something. Angel Kyodo Williams wrote she's an African-American who was practices in New York, but all over the place, that she wrote her more recent book is Radical Dharma, Talking Race, Love, and Liberation. And before that, she wrote, I think it's Being Black. And she was ordained, she was originally practicing with Pat Enkyo O'Hara in the Village Zendo in New York. And she was transmitted by a man named Francisco, I think it's Lugovinia, Paco, and in the Zen Peacemaker Order, which is a creature of Bernie Glassman, who is it's all in the Maizumi Roshi lineage. At any rate, she responded, and I'll come back to that, but it seems like a really useful question. You know, what about when we need to, or feel we need to do something? How do you make that decision? And we've been talking about that, it seems to me, you know, in various ways, and we're always talking about that in some sense. Well, you know, what does a bodhisattva do? Well, how do you respond? And that's, you know, I'm often saying, you know, live in the regular world with a mind of emptiness. But it's not easy. And it seems to me that right now we have lots and lots of decisions to make. You know, do you wear a mask or not? Do you self-quarantine? When do you go out? How much do you go out? How close do you get to people? Do you see people? Do you just meet on Zoom, or do you meet 6, 8, 10 feet apart in the yard? There's all those cautions about how often do you wash your hands? And how do you respond to people who are not wearing masks? And so on. All those sort of, I just wrote down COVID cautions. How do you handle that? And how do you respond to Black Lives Matter and systemic racism, white privilege, the upcoming election, your work, your family, and so on? There's lots of decisions that we make, often unwittingly, but sometimes they're big ones. And how do we address them while keeping this don't know mind? It's not easy. She talks about, she says, don't know mind is not so much not knowing. Instead, it's not knowing, which seems like a very useful way to think of it. Did I make that clear enough? Because when you read it, it would have like quotes or underlines in it. Don't know mind is not about not knowing. It's about not knowing. You know, it's about avoiding that sense of certainty, which is, I know. It's about keeping that mind of emptiness. As soon as you're sure, you're in trouble, right? So is that clear, the distinction? And this, just in the last week or so, it felt to me like this kind of distinction between sureness and not knowing was presented to me from two very different perspectives. One was something that my friend Alan Sanaki wrote about, I guess it was about Black Lives Matter or the current racial tension, systemic hoo-ha, white privilege, you name it. I haven't thought of a good phrase for all of it, but all of that. And then he was responding to somebody else's post, and it was very wise what he said, until he got to the end when he said that, I'm going to make it harder than it sounds, but because, you know, he said that it's time to pick sides, and I have picked a side. And I read that and I thought, no, don't be so sure. Don't make it an us-them. Don't make it a side. And I wrote to him about it, and we had some dialogue about it, because he understands that. So maybe it's, how do you pick a side without picking a side? I don't know. Because, and then somebody at the conference gave a talk, which to me was entirely on the side of emptiness. Like, wearing a mask and not wearing a mask, those are just two views. Well, I don't think they are just two views. They are just two views. And I talked to him about it, but I didn't get anywhere. But I think it's something that we need to struggle with, because as soon as we make it sides and make other, we're in trouble. We're in the poisonous sea. And we live in this world, and we, as bodhisattvas, I think we're working on being useful And we're working on being available to people, right? We're working on generosity. And we're working on greed, hate, and delusion. And isn't a lot of this about greed, hate, and delusion? The stew we're in right now. So what's a poor bodhisattva to do? And I think that we have to find a way to navigate these questions. And I really liked what she said, that the practice of not knowing, she says, it's a practice of not knowing. We practice tolerating this discomfort over and over again so that we no longer, or less often, which is one of the things I like about her, or less often impulsively react to the discomfort itself. And that just seems to me tremendously important, that that's part of what we're doing, sitting zazen, sitting still in the middle of difficulty and discomfort. And being able to be uncomfortable, being able to be afraid, being able to be angry, but without getting overwhelmed by these things, so that if we're frightened, we're not frightened of being afraid. We allow ourselves to be afraid. We allow ourselves to be angry. We allow ourselves to feel whatever we're feeling. And then once we're able to sit still in the middle of it and not get pulled around, then we can be quiet enough to allow a decision to make, to act, to arise, a decision to be made. But when it, and I want to read something she wrote, but I say this often in a slightly different way, but you know, when we can allow it to arise organically from the gut and not so much from the head, we can, I think, have more clarity about it. But also, it's not so much a decision to take a side, which implies against somebody, I think. There's my side and your side. You know, instead we can see it as joining with, aligning with, working with, compassion, feeling with. So this is what she said. She talked about, you know, the practice helps us to not be reactive and impulsive. And when our decisions grow out of, organically out of zazen, that's a whole different event. She talks about the Heart Sutra saying, Bodhisattva depends on Prajnaparamita, and what is it? And the mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist or arise or something like that. You know, when we think about things, I think that is when fear arises, it leads to that us-them kind of thing. Because we're not willing to sit still with the discomfort and the not knowing, and to be quiet enough and calm enough in the midst of whatever the discomfort is to allow the response to arise organically itself. So she says, to practice, to live into, what a great phrase, to live into the Zen teaching of don't know mind, to live into it until it becomes way, capital W-A-Y, you know, until it is really in your bones. That's not some philosophical exercise or a story of dead wise masters to replicate. It's a direct experience. It's a direct experience. You got to sit still in the middle of it. And as a result, incontrovertibly direct expression. Okay. So you live into this don't know mind until it becomes way. So this way is embodiment personified. So I think that's our aim, and that I think we need to act. I think we need to be useful in the world. I think we need to be able to relate to our own suffering and other suffering beings and not just say, oh, it's all part of the vast universal mind. Mask, not mask. They're just two views. When it's mask, not mask, it's a matter of life and death. I don't think they're just two views. But how do you wear a mask, make masks for others, talk to your family about it, that kind of thing? How do you do that without hating all those idiots in Texas? And if you do hate all those idiots in Texas, how do you work with that? How do you own that? How do you let go of that? That's the hard part. And the more we can remind ourselves about not thinking of it as sides and us, them, and remember that they are scared too, I think that's useful. So I said it all the time, but she says that the notion is that the action that's appropriate, the appropriate response arises organically once you are practicing the way, once you're quiet enough to allow it, once you're not being pulled around by your emotions so much, you can allow it. And once you're once your brain shuts up for a while, you can allow it. And those kinds of decisions are much more trustworthy. I talk often about my decision to go to Tassajara. And I thought I was ready to go, and then I was down there briefly, and I was driving out, I realized I was absolutely terrified. And found a five-day sesshin, luckily, pretty soon after I got back to Berkeley, and sat and realized in that process and talking to teachers that I had never really allowed the no to come up. I hadn't really explored what it meant for me to go away like that. And so I spent some time and backed away from saying I would go and spent some time with the no, with all the fear and confusion about it and so on. And eventually the decision to go arose more organically, came from here. And before it had been from here. And I could feel the difference. And that was my first really overt experience of that kind of thing. But I had to be quiet enough and open enough to allow that stuff to come up, because some of it was not pleasant. Some of it was fear of commitment, but some of it was plain old fear of what, I guess, of what might arise. I don't even remember. But I needed to do that. So I think that notion is that we need to practice, live into that not knowing. So then this direct experience of the decision arises. Or not. And if it doesn't, then maybe that means don't do. So when action organically arises, we can get out of the way when necessary. Having generated enough tolerance of not acting or needing action to be conclusive, it's just action, just this moment and the next, and so on. Without fixation on the action, the actor, or even the results, when such action is ethically grounded in meeting experience directly, we can't help but bring the heart of the whole world. We can't help but bring the heart of the whole world. We are without fixation, and yet we are accountable for every action we take, as a bodhisattva is, organically arising, wholehearted, being and doing the best we can. Pretty good. So, I struggle with this, and maybe we all do. I mean, I don't know about everybody, but those of us who practice with the impulse to take sides, or the impulse to do something to fix it, and I struggle with the impulse to make anybody who supports Donald Trump wrong, and the impulse to which I often give in to make fun of Donald Trump and to hate on him. So it's good to be reminded and to listen to her and to be confronted with these people. With Alan, it was just, you know, he was making a particular point, and you can't say everything all at once. But with my friend, who I think was stuck in emptiness, I tend not to go. I I tend not to get stuck in emptiness. But I don't know how much, you know, we have a tendency, you know, and so I tend to go to acting and the relative and fixing and so on. And so that's what I'm aware of that about me. And I think it's useful to be, whatever your tendency is, to be aware of it. And then you don't have to be stuck for very long. So how does this resonate with you guys? Kelly?
I just, especially right at the end there, you reminded me of something that happened to me the other day, where I walked into the house and Penn seemed a little bit upset about something. And so I sat down and I was like, hey, what's going on? And she told me, and it was kind of a minor conflict that had happened between her and Angel. And so I started like kind of going in depth and talking about things to do. And she looked at me, 10-year-old, she looked at me and went, oh no, I don't need you to do anything. I just wanted to talk about it for a minute. And she put me right in my place. And I said, okay, you can talk to me about this anytime. What do you want to do now? And moved on. And I this is how this resonated with me. I realized at that point that like every incident's different, and sometimes just do the thing that they're actually asking you to do to help. Nothing more.
Good kid. Steve?
The thing that resonates with me on this is that I have had a lot of workplace changes that some of you know about, including that I was a survivor of a pretty big layoff at work. And it's brought a lot of anger that I feel like a lot of the layoffs were totally unjustified, and I could go into it. But anyway, that my workplace sent out a survey shortly after that. And I looked and I made sure it was an anonymous survey done by a third party. And so I spoke my mind and felt really good for a minute. And I said things that I thought needed to be said. And I thought, no one will listen, but it's okay. I just want to say these things. Then as soon as the survey went out, like a couple hours later, I got one of my worst migraines in a long time. And so I agonized. Once I was kind of like feeling better from the migraine, even during the time, I was sort of agonizing, man, I probably went too far with my anger. I caused myself such pain and suffering. I have to hold back on that. And finally, I realized by talking to someone, talked to my therapist, and I realized I'm drawing all these causes and effects all the time. I'm saying, if I do this, I better be careful or else I'll give myself pain. And I just realized it's not so simple. I'm always making these dichotomies that if I do this, I'll have these consequences. And of course, there are consequences for everything we do, but it's not so straightforward. And sometimes, you know, I feel like I had to speak my truth. I had to speak, you know, from the anger. I wasn't hurtful. I just spoke what I thought was true. And I got a headache. And maybe they're related, maybe they weren't, but it didn't mean that I shouldn't have done one thing or the other. So it just resonates with me that, you know, that another reminder to hold on a little bit less loosely to these.
Well, or do you mean more loosely?
Knowing why and always wanting to know why things are. Pardon?
You said hold on less loose. You said hold on less loosely, and I think you wanted to be say more loosely to these ideas.
Is that right? Want to say more loosely. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds weird to say more loosely.
Yes. That is what I meant to say.
Yeah. Well, I think you know, you remind me of when somebody gets cancer, and then some people. Start telling them, if you didn't eat meat, you wouldn't get cancer, or you should have eaten more meat and then you wouldn't have gotten cancer, or, on and on. Because I think a lot of that is because we're all scared and we want, we want there to be a reason why, so then we can control whether it happens or not.
Yeah.
So I have theories about, what causes cancer, and then I can either eat meat or not eat meat, or I don't know. There's lots of things I can do or not do, and then I won't get cancer. Well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was magical thinking.
Yeah.
Thanks. Lisa?
Everything you said resonates, but I guess I don't know, like what you were saying about Alan Sanuka, about not taking sides.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how. How can I say that? And I wrote down, as I was taking notes, ask Mary, ask her to clarify this, because I don't know, like with something like Black Lives Matter and all of the racial stuff, I don't know how, it doesn't seem like sides to me. It just seems like there's right and everybody else is wrong. It doesn't seem like two sides.
Well, it does. Yeah, go on. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, I just don't know how to be open. And, I've talked to you about this, things that were going on with my family, and I don't know. I guess I don't want to let go of my side. I guess that's what it is. It's like a refusal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, these are just words, right? And what I was reacting to with Alan was this framing it in terms of sides. You can align yourself with the Black Lives Matter movement, say, or anti-racism work, say. Of course, that's sort of an implicit side, but at any rate, you can align yourself with these things without making the police devils or evil, without losing sight of their humanity. It doesn't mean that you don't set boundaries. It doesn't mean that you're not fierce. It doesn't mean that if you were the district attorney, it does not mean you would not prosecute. It does not mean that you might not work with, deconstructing the police, say, whatever it might be. But with what mind do you do it? Do you do it with not knowing, with not saying, this is absolutely right, which makes those who are not on your side absolutely wrong. And, it's partly about not hating. Nothing but hate comes from hate. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're I struggle with this because it's so easy to hate. Hate and gossiping about the Trump administration and so on is wicked fun. Mm-hmm. know, but I want to try to, you know, those cops for lots of reasons are afraid. It's just that they've been taught that and they've brought some of it on themselves. And I wonder, you know, when you kind of know that you're wrong, but you can't admit it, that feels really lousy. And you're afraid of whoever is making you, you know, rubbing your nose in it. You know, because usually if somebody criticizes you, there's a little truth in it. And it's easy to feel very resistant to that. So I just think that there's some kernel of that and with a lot of police people. I don't know. And that doesn't mean that I wouldn't I wouldn't go to a demonstration right now, but I would ordinarily and stand in front because white people are less likely to get smacked. Anyway, I don't know. Does that respond to you?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was talking about the kind of, because yeah, I think there are like, white people that are getting very triggered by all of this and just pushing even stronger against any kind of movement toward things changing. And I guess that's what I feel like, well, then I have to, I don't know. It's hard to explain. Like the whole Fox News narrative, I find it really hard to be open to that. Or do you just like, I don't know, like what you say, I do enjoy hating on Trump. Mm-hmm. I guess it's, maybe I should look at that more. I don't know.
Well, you know, even Kellyanne Conway said that the Kung Flu was a racist phrase. So you never know. Mm-hmm. You never know, but it's not easy, and anyway, this is it's not easy being a bodhisattva. You know, this practice is not easy. And she's talking one of the things about, you know, learning how to sit still with the discomfort,
or to say, "Oh, I don't know." But I guess that's what you were saying, the difference between not knowing and not knowing.
That's right. It's when we get into being adamant, mm-hmm. and certain that that we get in trouble. And it does not mean not acting. Mm-hmm. But Zach?
So your comment about cancer reminded me that a friend's wife died about 10 days ago, and she had been sick for years, and it would get better and worse, and it was clear that the end was coming, and I heard that she died. And my first reaction was to call him up or go to his house and see what I could do. But I kind of sat on it for a while, a few days, and decided instead to, I painted a card for him with plum blossoms and wrote some heartfelt thoughts. And he has a very wide network of friends and colleagues, and I'm sure he was being inundated with well wishes. And I thought I'd wait a little while before I called him. And I guess maybe this doesn't really fit what you're talking about, but sometimes I have to fight that initial instinct to go do something. kind of sleeping on it, so to speak, often chose the right thing to do. And so, you know, next week or soon, I'll give him a call and have a talk with him. But so maybe in some way that's an example. And some of the things you've said reminds me of the old saying, those who know don't know, and those who don't know know. And there's lots of examples of that. I can't think of one right now, but... Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's useful. And I think it makes a lot of sense to wait. You know, sometimes, it, you know, there's this flurry right after death, and then a couple of weeks later, not so much. And that's when, you know, it can be really useful sometimes. Anybody else? Sarah?
Yeah, I don't know, the teaching today reminds me of Martin Luther King's six steps of nonviolent system change or disobedience. And, you know, the end result is redemption and reconciliation. And right now, you know, people are so polarized, it's hard to see. And, you know, how is it possibly going to be any kind of reconciliation right now? But, you know, I feel blessed in a bizarre way of having a friend who is on the far right of the spectrum. He votes Trump, you know, he will defend his beliefs and, you know, but, and he's typical white uneducated male, you know, as that's, you know, the typical stereotype. But, you know, listening to him, he has, you know, a rich internal life. He has emotions. He has deep emotions and deep thoughts. And I think that with all this polarization, we have a hard time seeing that in the other side. That, you know, oh, these people are absolutely dumb. And, you know, they're completely, you know, who are these people? Are they Americans? You know, so there's that narrative going in our heads, you know, that these people are really horrible. But, you know, I'm also reminded, you know, back in the 80s when I really wanted to be a diplomat for, you know, in the Cold War. I wanted to go over there and talk to people and see what's going on, you know, because I thought, well, communications, it's miscommunication right now or no communication. And, you know, I got the chance to go and it was delightful because back then there were two sides. And we just had to get to know each other. So, yeah, and I don't know, the six steps of nonviolence, you know, I've been reading about these for about a couple of weeks now and, you know, kind of feeling them out and Ahimsa teachings. And, you know, the step number three is self-purification, meaning you get rid of all your violent tendencies, the way you talk, you know, and all of this sort of stuff. And that gets in the way of nonviolence. And so it's something that I've been thinking about lately. So anyway, that's all I have to say.
Thanks. I have I don't know if it's a quibble exactly, but the thing is, I don't think I'm ever going to get rid of all of my nonviolent tendencies. You know what I'm saying? I'm not going to get rid of my self-righteousness and my enjoyment of hating on somebody like Donald Trump. So I work with not being controlled by those things. I work on knowing when I'm doing it and letting it go or apologizing if I need to, whatever, that kind of thing. But I think that's sort of, that's maybe implicit in what she's talking about, in the sense that, you know, what she said, you know, so that then we're not reactive most of the time, or less often, I forget what phrase she used. But I think that the awareness of it and the working on it is the best we can do. Mm. And if I wait until I'm perfect, nothing, I'm never going to do anything. So anyway, so that's, you know, working on it, yes. And I'm sure that he had times when he, you know, came out of a meeting and vented. So, and he liked bourbon, so he must be a good guy.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, it's 11:15, so maybe it's time to stop. Okay. Beings are numberless. I